Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Kate Fuglai, author of The Soul of a Child, a novel based on the life of Maria Montessori, an Italian educator who founded the child-centered educational approach that still bears her name and is based on scientific observations of children. Welcome, Kate.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
I think Maria is a wonderful topic for us in these days of our deep interest in education and how it works. Why does Maria matter to us today?
I think Maria matters to us today because I think virtually any educational institution you go to, and this, I'm going to make a big statement here, has been influenced in some way by Maria Montessori. I think you have to go back to pre-Maria Montessori and some of the thinkers that influenced Maria in the 19th century, but you have to go back to education in that time and say that most education, and certainly elementary education, there were virtually no preschools in the, let's say, 1880s, 1870s, certainly in Italy, most throughout Europe and America, consisted of children sitting on benches with horn books, and teachers had the sort of John Lockean way of educating children, which was that they were a tabula rasa, they were empty vessels waiting to be filled up. And the teacher, who was often a wizened, grim, gray, bored person, stood at the front of the room and went through rote learning. And children repeated things that they were memorized, and there was no physical education, there were no balls, there were no bats, there was no attention to their physical life. And they basically sat on benches if they were lucky enough to go to school. And that's the kind of education that Maria Montessori had. And that was prevalent almost everywhere. And Maria Montessori was one of the first people that changed the face of education and changed it to what we now call, it's a very popular term, child-centered education. But before Maria Montessori became world famous and lectured all over, she began in Italy, and she nearly went all over the world, and she became world famous. That's what education was. And in specifically, when you go into, for example, everyone is used to a preschool or a kindergarten class where there are small tables and chairs and small cupboards where children go and get things. That all, I wouldn't say it all emanates from Maria Montessori, but it began with Maria Montessori. So we owe a huge debt of gratitude to her. And I think she, in that way, she influences all our lives every day.
I love that. I agree. I agree 100%. And that we don't focus enough on attention in the way she did. What interests me about her when I first started reading about her and reading your book was that she didn't start out to study to be a teacher or an educator. She went to medical school.
That's right. Some people may quibble, and there may have been one or two other people that did this prior to Maria Montessori. But in a lot of my research, it indicates she was the first woman in Italy to receive a medical degree, to become a doctor.
I had not heard that. How fascinating.
And she started out in a family. She was the only child, and her parents were very encouraging of her, especially her mother. But by the time she got to high school, she decided she wanted to become an engineer. And by this time, her father was—he was a minister of agriculture, and they had moved from a small town to Florence to Rome, and they grudgingly allowed her to go to high school, but were not terribly—her father, in particular, wasn't terribly thrilled. And when she finished high school, the options for a woman at that time were to marry, become a nun, or maybe a teacher.
Or a nun and a teacher.
Yeah, or a nun and a teacher. And she decided that she was going to become a doctor. And her father was vehemently against it, in fact, ashamed of her. And she went to have an interview, And they, you know, the man interviewing her that was the head of the medical school at the University of Rome said, you have perfect grades, you're obviously very intelligent, but this can't happen. And so she stood up and said, well, I am going to become a doctor, no matter what you say. So she and her mother started a campaign, and they got letters from everyone they knew, including some people say the Pope. But at any rate, she was finally admitted, however grudgingly, and she had to, go the first day of medical school. It was all male. No one wanted her there. She tells stories during her life about having her chair kicked and, you know, being insulted, going through years of isolation, loneliness, but she was determined to do it. And in fact, at one point, there was a dissection part, I think in her third year, and they felt it was inappropriate for a woman to be with men and a naked body. So she had to do the dissection on her own late at night.
Oh, God.
And it almost downed her. I mean, she almost said, I can't do this. But she did manage to get through, and so she was the first woman to graduate with a medical degree. And she decided that she was also interested in, she got her own practice. She was interested in women's medicine, and she started to become a doctor to indigent women and people who couldn't afford to go to doctors. And Maria was still living with her parents. People would come late at night knocking on the door, and she would be taken to the slums of Rome. And the first thing she did, in addition to helping women with their labor, was to realize that they needed nutrition. They needed a clean place to have their children. She personally washed windows, made soup, nourished the mother, and began a whole practice of holistically looking at human beings rather than just treating a medical condition. So she started out as a scientist and a doctor. She ultimately was hired to be the head of the orthophrenic college and school, which dealt with people with mental diseases, mental disturbances. They didn't trust a woman to be ahead of it alone, so they hired a man to also work with her.
Share
so they
the title.
They teamed up, and his name was Giuseppe Montesano. And so they ran the school for a while, and she used her scientific observations. She always had a habit, based on her scientific education, of using note cards for every patient and taking extensive notes, weight, all kinds of observations. And so she came from a background of science. So yes, that was sort of her young life. She definitely did not set out to be an educator.
Interesting. But clearly she respected education because she knew that she wanted it so badly.
Absolutely.
And then she respected women and children, which other doctors at the time weren't paying that much attention to.
Exactly. And the other thing, when she graduated from medical school, she was so impressive that the head of the University of Rome decided to send her to an international women's conference in Berlin. So when she was 26 years old, I think, she went to make this speech, and there were women from all over the world. And in it, because the other thing about her, in addition to being a medical doctor, she spoke about the fact that women should get equal pay. This was 1897. Women should get equal pay. Women should be allowed to work and do what they wanted to do and live the lives they wanted to. And women should, and their children should have childcare. Families should have childcare. We're still arguing for this.
Exactly.
But she was talking about this, and it was, you can imagine how revolutionary it was.
How radical she must have been.
1897.
Yes, might as well be Margaret Sanger. She's
exactly.
just this step away from talking about birth control.
Exactly.
Wow.
Now, the interesting thing, you bring that up, because the man with whom she was teamed at the Orthophrenic Institute, she fell in love with. She had a love affair. And when she went to the conference, I believe, she was pregnant at the time.
Wow.
In the research I've been able to do, his family was very wealthy. Mm. And they said, he said, I want to marry you, but of course you'll give up your you'll give up your profession. You can move to, I think it was the south of Italy, live in, on the estate and raise our son, and that's what we'll do.
That's your life.
And she said, no.
Even though she loved him.
One would presume she did.
Right.
But she was not going to give up. So she went to a convent. She had her child, and he was raised by a farm family outside Rome. And she went to see him as often as she could, and he grew up knowing her as his auntie.
Aunt.
I'm making air quotes.
Right.
His aunt.
Goodness.
And so it's kind of a fascinating, what I say in the book is she spent her life helping other children and helping women so that they would not have to farm out their children. But her own son, she had to keep a secret from society because obviously it would have, so her choice was either to give up her career and everything she'd worked for 27 years, or to continue. And of course, if the public had known about this, it would have ruined her. Yeah, so it's an interesting side note. And of course, when I discovered all this, it was really, it made it very poignant, very, very poignant. And I can tell you more about what happened with her son and so forth.
Oh, well, definitely.
Mario.
Hearing that. That's wonderful. Well, so is there anything else about her childhood that you think helped mold this deep desire to help other people? Was there something, you know, in her relationship with her mother or something that made her want to be that person that didn't exist for her? There's no role model for this.
Right. I think that she, for one thing, her mother never shielded her from poor people or, you know, they moved from a small town where there probably wasn't a lot of destitution. But when they moved to Rome, she saw a lot of that. And her mother also always supported the poor. They knitted for the poor. They gave food. They were very involved in social justice. So I think from her mother, definitely. But she was a brilliant young woman just from the get-go. She was born that way. She was incredibly adept from the time she was 4 years old. Very advanced.
You have to imagine, if you're that smart, you just can't do anything else.
Right.
How smart do you have to be to not let the rest of society convince you to go another way?
Exactly. Exactly. And I think that when the work at the Orthophrenic Hospital, she was very, very moved by the fact that, as you can imagine, just like education, the state of education at the time was not so great. If you were in a mental institution, it was really horrible. At one point, she went to visit many of them, and she had many patients, but she went to visit a hospital, and she saw, they had nothing to do. They just put these people in rooms and locked them in, and she saw patients with little crumbs of food lining them up and making little, you know, squares and circles, and the woman that was showing her around said, "Isn't that disgusting?" And Maria said to herself, "No, they're trying to do something." So she got materials for these people to work with, and I think this was a room of children, and she cut out letters, and she put sandpaper on one side so they could feel the shape of them, and she worked with them with very crude materials. Flags, little blocks that had different sizes and that they could stack in different shapes. A year later, they gave these students a test, and they equaled, quote-unquote, normal students. So she started developing materials to work with mentally disturbed patients initially.
Right.
She also, at the same time, she was in her late 20s at this time, she also started lecturing all over. So she became very well known in Europe and in Italy. And at the same time, this incident happened with having a child, and she realized she could no longer work at this hospital with Giuseppe Montesano. Uh-huh. So sometimes things, challenges that happen in our lives turn us on a different road. It certainly turned her. She decided to give up her work as a doctor at the Orthophrenic Institute, and everyone was shocked and appalled, and she decided she was going to go back to the University of Rome and study anthropology and psychology. Ah. And so that's what sort of turned her onto that road. And she was getting a master's degree, but clearly all the students knew she was this special person because she had this scientific background and she was a doctor. So quickly she began lecturing at the University of Rome and working with the anthropologists there and the psychologists there. So she was very well known. And it was a time in Rome when there was a lot, it was the reunification.
Correct.
There was a lot of reformation going on and a lot of building happening. And there was one area called the San Lorenzo District where a lot of, let's say, extra buildings had been built and wealthy people had not occupied them. And there was sort of a lot of squatters, prostitution, drug rings, and so forth. And they wanted to do something about it. So some reformers got working class people installed in these homes. And the working class people worked at factories on the outside of Rome. And they left their children at home during the day. And the children were defacing the properties. They were, running around crazily. So the government in Rome thought they needed somebody to corral these children. And someone suggested, I don't know how, Maria Montessori. So they went to her just to ask her, we just need some farm girl to corral these kids. That's all we need. And Maria Montessori said, well, what about me? And at this point, all of her colleagues, her parents, everyone said, are you out of your mind? You're a medical doctor. You could have tenure at the university. Everyone said, don't do this, don't do this.
What a waste.
And on January 6th, I think 1903, it was Epiphany. Interesting day. She opened what she called Casa dei Bambini in the San Lorenzo district in the city of Rome. And it was a school, and it was called the Home for Children. And she sent out, she had almost no money to do it for materials or anything else. She hired one young woman who lived in the neighborhood, and they sent out flyers. No one could read. Of course, most of the parents were illiterate. And they said, there's two rules. You have to bring the children to school clean, and you have to bring them on time, and you have to agree to twice a month, bi-monthly meetings with Dr. Montessori to talk about the development of your child. And if the child misbehaves horribly, they can't come. That was it. And so opening day happened, and people walked into the schoolroom, and there were tables with linen tablecloths and pots of flowers, and it was freshly painted, and she had done all this, and the rules were very clear, and I don't want to go on and on.
But I think that's beautiful. What's happening is she's treating them respectfully, and therefore they will behave respectfully, because where else would they get to spend time in such an elegant and beautiful place? It's a pretty example of how I treat you, you'll treat me back.
Yes, exactly. And she had them all wear aprons, and she said to the parents, just like you're going off to work at the factory, this is the children's work. So they're coming here, they're putting on their apron. This is their uniform, and this is their work. And she saw children's play as their work, as their way of developing.
And that's what strikes me as very interesting, because we have so many arguments about, you know, even though she was doing that, we still have schools that were doing rote teaching and all of that, and this idea of play is a waste of time. But she recognized that we learn through play, And we're kind of, I mean, we came back to that earlier in society, but still, there's still an argument about that. What's the better idea? Should we all memorize the multiplication tables and that's it? Or should we use manipulatives in the room? And how does that help? And the science of how that helps. And she knew that 100 years ago.
She developed these ideas by observation. And again, it goes back to she was a scientist. So every day, I think at first, every day, every child was weighed. They were observed. They had huge stacks of note cards on each child. I don't know. Some people may have some idea as Montessori is this place where kids are just running around crazily.
Loose. Kind of. Yes. And they never learn to read until they're 14, and it's a waste of time. And I've heard
right.
the arguments.
Yes, exactly. It doesn't sound like it was that way or that they're that way. That has not been my observation. There were definite rules that each child could take out whatever they wanted to work with, whatever kit or whatever she called it. She ended up calling the materials that she developed her apparatus. But they were not toys.
Of course
and
not.
People, Americans called them that. But anyway, they're not toys. And the rule was you could take it, you could work with it as long as you wanted to. If you wanted to do it 50 times, you could do it. She believed that is how a person develops mastery.
Which is what Malcolm Gladwell says. He's the guy who says so many 10,000
yes.
hours makes you a master at something.
Exactly, exactly. If a child was working with something, another child was not allowed to interrupt them or to take it from them. When they were finished, they had to put it back exactly where it was, where they'd gotten it. So it was a very ordered. She was from a military family. Her father was a military man. So it was a very ordered atmosphere and a very peaceful, calm atmosphere, supposedly. And she believed that children had what she called sensitive periods where they needed to do certain things. And I know you've raised a child, I've raised two, and I know that with my children, they had times in their lives where they would do the same, whatever it was, whether it was bouncing a basketball or. And she also believed very strongly in the interconnection between the physical and the mental. I mean, everyone's probably familiar with the lacing boards, the I mentioned before, numbers and letters that had, they were shaped, they were always painted primary colors. On the back was often sandpaper or a tactile.
Right.
So she really believed in the mental as well as the tactile and the physical. And then, of course, part of the school was cooking, serving, and cleaning up their food, and she used glass bowls and glass glasses and hot foods, and children had to walk carefully with the soup tureen and serve one another, and then also physical activity, marching, singing, clapping, all these things were also part of the day. And again, this was completely revolutionary. There were educators in other countries, in France, in Germany, that had similar ideas, but they did not, you know, they did not promulgate like Maria Montessori did.
How fun. So, because we just mentioned this concept of sort of what do people think about Montessori school, what did you know about Montessori education before you went into writing this?
I think all I knew, I had a vague notion that it was either kind of airy-fairy. Or, yeah, I'm just, you know, it's
yeah.
kind of airy fairy.
That's.
Or sort of some weird rote thing that kids did. But I've been completely disabused of that notion since.
I had to imagine that it was more than I thought it was, because if I'm not incorrect, she was the first, she was the woman, one of the women in Italy who had her face on currency.
Yes.
Which was when they had their own currency, obviously. But how impressive, because, of course, in America, we don't have any women on our currency, and here they were with this woman. How important must she have been to have earned that in a country not known for being wildly supportive of women and that sort of thing? Which, again, goes back to how did she get to do as much as she did when she was a woman in that at the turn of the last century?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things was stamina, 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 and vision. Her vision really was that through education we can achieve world peace.
That was her, I buy that.
That was her vision, you know, and it's what drove her whole life. And she began opening other Montessori schools almost immediately. So the first one obviously was in Rome, then Milan, then it just exploded. And she started getting letters and requests. And at the same time, she was still lecturing all over Europe. But she got requests to open schools in... So within 5 years, there were Montessori schools in the Netherlands, in Germany, in France, in England, in Spain. And it eventually expanded to Japan, India. I mean, you know, at the end of her career. But... there's an interesting but in all that, which is that she did have a, and, you know, like it or not, whether we feel this was a good thing or not, she insisted on training all the teachers herself.
Well, it was her system, and she wanted to make sure you were following it.
Exactly. Because as soon as you have a system, you have people who want to change it.
Correct.
And so... there's a whole portion of the journey, because one question might be, why, if this is such a great, if she was so great, and if the system was so great, why isn't everything Montessori?
Correct. Yes.
So, she became world famous. There were Montessori schools all over Europe. And, of course, the Americans became fascinated and interested, and there were a few Montessori schools that opened here. It's kind of a typically American story. There was a famous magazine at the turn of the century called McClure's magazine.
Yes, right.
Ida Tarbell, you know, Lincoln Steffens. It was the original muckraking magazine. And it was owned and run by this S.S. McClure. But the magazine had fallen on hard times. And the reason I bring him up is that one of his writers had done a series of articles about Montessori. And McClure thought, being a typical American entrepreneur and needing money because his magazine had fallen on hard times, thought, I will team up with Montessori and make a profit off her lectures and off her school.
Of course. Where's the money in it?
He failed to tell Montessori this. And he invited her to America on what you might say were slightly false pretenses. He said, you know, I'm going to arrange this lecture tour, and then let's talk about, you know. And by this time, Montessori had developed a whole series of these apparatus, these items to be used in conjunction with schools in her system. So she came to America and quickly realized that there was an agent, very fancy hotels, and that the men, the agent, Lee Kedick and McClure, said, oh, don't worry about the receipts. Don't worry. You know, we'll take care of the ledger books. And we'll take care of all that. You just talk about a little bit about, Montessori, but not too much, because Americans don't want to.
Don't give it away.
Right. And she immediately stood up to them and said, first of all, no, I'm going to speak for 2 hours about my system, how I developed it. As she toured through America, she grew increasingly alarmed with people that came up to her and said things like, my children have your toys in our house, and they don't know. And so, people were, it's a long story, right. But the point is, people were making great profit off of her, and she went back to Italy, and I think it steeled her against being taken advantage of ever again. So
Children are the ones who lost out.
Exactly. And it soured her, and of course it soured a lot of the people in America about Montessori schools. Now, some of her acolytes in America had offshoots of Montessori. And there are still obviously Montessori schools here, right. But it's an interesting story about capitalism versus
altruism.
You know, yeah, and male versus, you know.
Right.
You know. So that was who she was, and she was very much in control. And people throughout her life suggested that sometimes you have to let go a little control and she was very, you might say strong, other people would say rigid, but
correct.
That's who she was.
Wow.
That's who she was.
So because of the time frame in which she lived, I'm wondering what was the effect of the World Wars on her fame and her schools, because now it's an Italian system at a time when Americans don't want to like Italian things.
Yes. Well, that's a great question, because between the wars, we know what happened in Italy. And Mussolini actually became very enamored of Montessori and her school system, because he said, it's like magic. You can teach three-year-olds math, right? You know, and I have a whole chapter in the book where she goes to see Montessori, and apparently it was true. He had a lion cub in his office, and, you know, and he loved Montessori. He loved the idea. All he heard was Italian children will learn to read at three, and it's a magic system, and I'll give you everything you want. Now, her son, Mario, who by this time, she still did not claim him as her son, but he was an associate, and he had married himself, and he lived in Barcelona and ran a school there, but helped her run this whole empire. And Mario was skeptical because he was reading the newspapers, and she was too. But other people said, you're doing this for the benefit of the children of Italy.
Right. It doesn't matter who the leader is. They'll change. Right.
But there came a day when, I think it was like 1939, when someone came to the door and said, Mussolini has declared that all children must wear uniforms, must sing, you know, fascist songs, must do the fascist salute. And she said, no.
Not in my system.
No. Yeah. She said, I am about all children, not just... And she had also gone and made a speech in, I think, Denmark, basically decrying fascism and saying, I am about all the children of the world, not just... And so the next day, all of her schools were closed and in Italy. And she went to Barcelona, and eventually, when the war broke out, they ended up going to the Netherlands, and that's where... And actually, the Netherlands... Let's say the Netherlands behaved. They did. They ran the Montessori schools as she wanted them to be run.
Proper.
And so they ended up in 1940-41 in the Netherlands. And one of the students in her schools was Anne Frank.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that was really, really touching to me when
what
I found that out.
Oh, I'd never heard that before.
Yeah. Yeah. And then interestingly, at the beginning, right before World War II broke out, she spoke at a huge conference, and a huge, huge group of people from India were there, and they begged her to come to India. They said India would be the perfect place for Montessori. Right. So she and Mario went to India for an 8-month stay. And by this time, Mario had 4 children. And they stayed behind in the Netherlands. But when the war broke out, it was a British colony.
Yes.
And they were Italians. Italian. Were, and so they were exiled in India through the whole war.
Wow. What theme do you think ran through her life?
I honestly think that her life was about creating children who could change the face of the future. And I think that she lived through 2 world wars and the atomic age. And I think she, like other deep visionary thinkers of the time, felt that we were a planet in peril. And she felt that the development of children was the most important thing that we as human beings can do, and to let them develop to their greatest potential. And that would be the greatest way to move toward a peaceful planet. And I really believe that she believed that.
And I agree.
Yeah.
Wow, that's beautiful. So who was her mentor in life?
I think she had several. I think there was a professor at the University of Rome who believed in her and who really turned around. Bacelli, this the man who initially interviewed her, came to respect her immensely. You know, there's a story about a blizzard that happened one day, and no one else showed up, but she got there, and he was there, and he, you know. So I think her relationship with her son was one of the most important ones in her life, and I think that, if not the most, and I think that she missed out on his childhood, and then oddly, they had this weird sort of time in India, and they almost made up in later life for what they didn't have when he was young. And he by all accounts, was a wonderful human being, too.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah. That's so beautiful. Yeah. So I always end by asking people, who are your mentors?
Oh, my goodness. I would say one of my mentors is a wonderful man who passed away, but his name was Paul Walker. And he, too, was an educator and an actor and a teacher. And he was a teacher of theater games, interestingly. And he believed that through improvisation and theater games and working communally in the theater, people can develop and connect. And I think that's something that is very important to me.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much for coming today.
You are so welcome. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.